It's a woman's world. That's what we're going to be talking about, and isn't it, though? Come on! Over half of the world's population are women. So let's honor that and respect that and figure out how we can help women by understanding and appreciating the differences that might need to be considered to tailor treatments. So, if you walk away from this talk with anything, I hope that you'll walk away with the appreciation that there are some very important differences that women have in their brains and the hormone system that need to be considered when you're evaluating and treating them. So we'll start with some epidemiology and talk about the source or cause of mental health issues in females across the lifespan, and also talk to you about some evidence-based treatment strategies for managing more female-specific mental health issues like postpartum depression, and we'll talk about menopause as well. Sex differences in mental illness are common for very specific psychiatric disorders, and here's a chart that graphically shows you the distribution of some disorders that perhaps are more intuitive than others, like eating disorders and post-traumatic stress, anxiety, and mood disorders. Whereas you see more of the psychotic spectrum and substance use disorders either are the same or are more male dominant. So these are the conditions that you might be thinking about, and we're gonna hone in on mood disorders today because there is a very unique opportunity to understand the way in which mood disorders and the physiology of the reproductive cycle, the female reproductive cycle, actually overlay and help us understand why these conditions seem to occur more frequently in women than men. So the heightened prevalence of mood disorders in women persists across adulthood. So it's something that once you see the sex differences, the predominance that you do see kind of sticks around throughout the life. And for some women, increased risk for depression and anxiety disorders is also associated with reproductive cycle events. Substantial hormone variations, stress, changes in personal, family, and professional responsibilities, very unique to women. And here's a graphical representation of how you might imagine the reproductive cycle overlays with risk for depression across age categories. And this just illustrates and drives home the point that it is indeed across the lifespan. And what's nice about this graph is it also shows you below the hormonal levels across the female life cycle. And what you can now understand and appreciate is that because of the changes and shifts in the female life cycle, those also seem to increase the risk or rates of depression. So here are the mood disorders that we're going to talk about today. Premenstrual syndrome, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, perinatal depression, and perimenopausal depression. And you can see some of the prevalence rates provided for you here. All right, let's talk physiology for a minute. I'm going to take a little bit of time to walk through this slide. It's complicated, but I think what it'll do is set the stage for the rest of the presentation, and it'll help you understand perhaps why treatments are indicated for these conditions in terms of their mechanisms of action. So there are a number of variables that contribute to hormone functioning, as well as our response, our body's response to stress. There might be person-level variables, and they contribute, for example, to very specific neurotransmitters in the brain. The brain that is able to stop, think for a minute, is often that ability to stop and think for a minute is often governed by our inhibitory hormone, GABA. And the altered GABA-A receptor composition also contributes to why we begin and respond to stress. Similarly, neuroactive steroids are also impacted by person-level factors, as well as the serotonin system. Now, you add reproductive mood disorders to this equation, like premenstrual, perinatal, and perimenopausal, right? Those key sentinel critical periods when you might see an uptick of these conditions. They're explained by this combination or really interesting confluence of the predisposition as well as the situational variables that contributes, like psychosocial stress. And so, humor me if you will, this is, in my mind, just a beautiful description of how these systems kind of work and interact with one another. And the reason why I like it is because it shows you the hypothalamic gonadotropic pituitary axis and the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis side by side. This, the one on this side, the HPG axis, is the steroid system that governs the reproductive cycle. And the one on the right governs your stress steroid system, your body's stress response. Notice that they're working together harmoniously to regulate around situational stress. So when you appreciate and understand that, as well as the composition of the hormones that are traveling between these systems, including GABA-A and serotonin, everything else I say will make, hopefully, more sense. So let's start with premenstrual syndrome first. You can have a varying degree of severity, from none to severe, and the milder cases we might affectionately call PMS, and then the more severe cases really formalize to a disorder or dysfunction for folks. And it's indeed characterized all along this continuum by cyclic recurrence of symptoms during the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle. Symptoms diminish rapidly with onset of menses. So when a woman is having her period, you see actually a reduction in symptoms. The most prominent and consistent symptoms are irritability, tension, and dysphoria. So how do you make a diagnosis? Well, it requires a thorough history, a physical exam, and some symptom evaluation that you're gonna measure and track. And patients should help you out with that. They should be instructed to complete daily symptom charting over 2 menstrual cycles. Without that data, it becomes very difficult to figure out that relationship between your reproductive cycle and your stress response. So it's very important to do that and to have that data in order to be able to make the formalized diagnosis. You also need at least 5 symptoms, 5 out of 11, and one must be at least a key mood symptom. And symptoms must be present in the last week of the luteal phase, lessened during menstruation, and absent in the follicular phase. So it's helpful when patients are charting to instruct them and educate them about the reproductive cycle. Symptoms must also be severe enough that they interfere with functioning, relationships, and activities. So what are the symptoms? You can see these are the 11 symptoms that are included in the DSM that might lead to a diagnosis. And I've bolded here for you the 4 that are mood, and one of them must be mood in order for you to make a diagnosis. You following? Everybody good? All right, so now it should make sense that first line treatments for PMDD involve the serotonergic system, right? SSRIs, first line. You've got several that are FDA approved here, and then you've got an oral contraceptive. Makes sense. You've got your reproductive cycle regulation and your stress hormone regulation. Second line are listed here. Some of the norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. You'll notice that citalopram is not among the first lines because the evidence base for it isn't as strong. Open label studies that aren't controlled. And then you also see down below some steroid acting agents. So that also makes sense given the importance of the neurosteroid function that regulates the reproductive cycle. Here are some lists of third and fourth line, and in the interest of time, I'm just gonna let you read that at your leisure. And just important footnotes there that cognitive behavioral therapy adjunctive to SSRIs show longer term therapeutic benefits than SSRIs alone, and lifestyle modifications like exercise, diet, might improve some symptoms, but are often insufficient. So it's very important that we don't just push the lifestyle and not watch for and follow up with our patients to look for response to those initial lifestyle modification strategies. It's very invalidating for patients to hear, you know, doc, I've tried exercise, you know, help me out here. We've done this. Let's try something else. So it's just important for you to keep that in mind. Let's talk next about peripartum depression. Here, what we do in DSM-5 is we give a qualifier. It's major depressive disorder with peripartum onset. So at any point during the pregnancy. Same criteria as major depression, which you all know. So we're not going to recap those. They're right there for you in case you need to reference them. Peripartum specifier stipulates that symptom onset during pregnancy and has to occur within 4 weeks of delivery. Okay, so that's what makes it peripartum. Important to note so that you don't confuse it with postpartum. Okay? And in clinical practice and research, symptom onset's usually within 12 months of delivery and may be considered postpartum. So now here's the language for the distinction between peripartum and postpartum. So how do you screen for perinatal depression? You've got our OBGYN folks, the American College, as well as the US Preventative Service Task Force that have actually helped us out in our field and mental health to make a very important and strong statement that we need to screen for depression for everyone who is pregnant. That's very important. Screening for depression and anxiety at least once during the perinatal period, a full assessment of mood and emotional well-being during the comprehensive postpartum visit is necessary. Across my 3 pregnancies, I got the PHQ-9, I got the whole deal, and I was very glad that they did that, and I thanked them for it. Standardized and validated screening tools should be used, and you've got some options here. The Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale is somewhat of a clinical interview. The PHQ-9, as Dr. Citrome mentioned in his presentation last time, is something that you can just give to the patient to fill out super easy and do some screening from that. Just be sure to look at it and encourage your colleagues in primary care to do so as well. Perinatal mental health during COVID has been particularly complicated, so it's very important for us to be aware of the barriers to screening for depression and other mood disorders because of the vulnerabilities of not being able to attend antenatal care or having appointments by telephone or having to do them online. And as a result, there's also been a lack of adequate support from relatives and friends. Pandemics created lots and lots of complications for us, in addition to some financial difficulties that patients might experience and increased risk for intimate partner and domestic violence. In telehealth, I've had the unfortunate experience of seeing some of this, as I'm sure some of you may have as well. It's heartbreaking, and it's really hard to watch that stress. Helpful to get a sense of what's going on at home, but very important to be aware of. And so because of this compounding stress with the pandemic and less social support in perinatal women, this is especially true in our racial and ethnic minorities and lower income status patients. So how should we treat depression during pregnancy? There's lots of psychological interventions that are considered first line treatments for more mild to moderate forms of depression. And you would consider pharmacological treatments alone or in combination in these cases. Severe depression, maybe moderate to severe major depression in earlier in life. Persistent symptoms despite other interventions like therapy. Didn't work, so gotta try something different. Busy slide, so I'm just gonna kind of highlight a few things here just to kind of give you a gestalt of how I think about management of depression in pregnancy. The way you think about it, the way I think about it is I want to know if the woman is actually currently taking a medication or not. If she's taking a medication, then the discussion must be, do you want to continue it? If she's not, then you might opt for more psychotherapy to start, especially if they're concerned or hesitant to try a medication. For women who prefer medications, the risk-benefit treatment choices need to be evaluated and discussed, like factors like stage of gestation, because they might have some concerns about that, and fetal defects, and symptoms prior to history of depression or other conditions and circumstances might weigh in terms of patient preference. For those women who are currently already on medication, I think the education about what they're taking, how to discontinue the medication if they want to be tapered off, what their symptoms are, and how to weigh the relative risk of leaving those symptoms untreated and replacing it with psychotherapy or augmenting medications needs to also be included in that discussion. And if a patient refuses medication, alternative treatments and monitoring should be in place, preferably before you discontinue the drug, because you already know that while discontinuation is occurring, there's already going to be a lot of stress and not enough to help manage and support it. So why are these discussions so important? Well, SSRIs are the most used antidepressants during pregnancy, and you've got about a 5.5 prevalence in North America. Recent findings suggest that pharmacological treatment of depression really helps mothers be assured that the absolute risk of malformations and persistent pulmonary hypertension with SSRI exposure is relatively small. So again, when you're weighing that risk and benefit, it's just helpful for you to make sure that that information is conveyed so that you can collaborate with the patient to make an educated decision. And why is this important? Well, it's because untreated depression during pregnancy is associated with, as you saw in the pretest question, increased risk for preterm birth, low birth weight, and fetal growth restriction. And I'm really pleased to see that you're all aware of this situation in the way that you responded to the pretest question. How do you treat postpartum depression? Well, there's like a range, right? We talked about mild, moderate, and severe forms. For everyone with postpartum depression, you've got to do the lifestyle stuff. For the more moderate cases, you might consider a psychosocial addition, like cognitive behavioral therapy and interpersonal therapy. Maybe add an SSRI or brexanolone is indicated for moderate PPD. And more severe cases might require more combination treatments, like SSRIs alone or with psychological intervention. Consider switching or augmenting. If the SSRI alone isn't working, consider brexanolone, which we'll talk about in a minute. And in the most severe cases, ECT. So now let's take a look at the data, the evidence base for psychological interventions for reduction of depression symptom severity in postpartum women. This has been looked at around the world, from Australia to America, all over. And many, now this synthetic review shows that basically any of these psychosocial interventions work better than a control therapeutic intervention and reduce depressive symptoms 6 months post-intervention and are significantly better than control conditions in reducing depressive symptoms below threshold levels. So the data are clear that psychosocial interventions are really important and work. How about for SSRIs? In this synthetic meta-analysis, you see looking at randomized controlled trials comparing SSRIs to placebos in women with postpartum depression. Again, SSRIs are very clearly more effective in treating PPD than placebo, but due to a low quality of evidence, we still need more research. There aren't enough studies here to take it to the bank. So what else is out there? Well, we've got brexanolone for postpartum depression. I'll tell you in a minute how it works, but it's the only FDA-approved, got emergency authorization treatment for postpartum depression. Neuroactive steroid, chemically similar to allopregnanolone. And what it does is it's a positive allosteric modulator of the GABA-A receptor. And I'll tell you in a minute why this mechanism of action is very useful in the postpartum period. It's administered IV over 60 hours in a single dose, so it's infused. Adverse events include dizziness and somnolence and requires enrollment in risk evaluation and mitigation strategies. It's an infusion, so you've got some safety concerns that you've got to make sure you monitor. So how does it work? Well, if you look at the graph at the top, you'll notice the natural ways in which the neurosteroids in the brain work and what how they peak and trough during the course of from pre-pregnancy to postpartum. And if you notice below, there's a nice little cartoon that shows you what receptors are present in pre-pregnancy, pregnancy, and postpartum. And what this cartoon very nicely shows you is that during pregnancy, synaptic GABA-A receptors and extrasynaptic GABA receptors are reduced in pregnancy, okay? And then in the postpartum period, they're restored again. What brexanolone does, it's allosterically modulating to help restore receptors that don't get restored in the case of postpartum depression. So what you're seeing here again is an interaction between the reproductive cycle, our natural ways of responding to stress, and the important governing principle of the GABA, the role of the GABA-A receptor. How effective is it? You get a peak response that beats placebo at 36 hours and at 60 hours. A little bit more pronounced at 60 hours, so this is why the infusion is indicated for 60 hours. But it's expensive. $34,000 per treatment alone. Available only through this restricted program. Few physicians have experience using it, and the efficacy and safety data are still emerging. And I think from a practical perspective, one of the things that I think about postpartum is that bonding period, that really important bonding period between the mother and child that can be interrupted during this 60-hour infusion. So it may be advantageous for patients requiring rapid response because their severity of illness is so bad, because in the long term, that's actually better for that bonding to get the mom well quickly. But you can see the limitations. There's an oral version of something similar called zuranolone for severe postpartum depression. And here's a randomized phase 3 randomized double-blind study in women with severe postpartum depression. Very, very promising separation from placebo. And you get that very, very quickly at the 3-day time point and continues and remains 45 days out. Most common adverse events, this is an oral version, so it's much more accessible. And it, you know, the randomized controlled trial used an oral dose of 30 milligrams versus placebo for 2 weeks. And the side effects included somnolence, headache, dizziness, upper respiratory infection, diarrhea, and sedation. So stay tuned, hoping to see something. This is just hot off the press, but maybe we'll have an oral alternative to brexanolone online soon. For other severe postpartum depression cases, you might consider electroconvulsive therapy. And here is a study published in 2018 that shows you that the proportion of responders in ECT in cases with postpartum depression and or psychosis in relation to severity of symptoms prior to treatment. And you can see that the responders are clearly outdoing the non-responders in this graphical representation. Okay, some other things you can try in this slide if other agents aren't working. And counseling services for everyone is necessary. But say, for example, you have a woman who isn't necessarily declaring herself to having depression, but might be high risk, might have a history of depression, maybe experiencing current depression, low income, young or single parenthood. These are all risk factors, and cognitive behavioral therapy and interpersonal therapy are recommended for these women. Okay, let's talk about depression and perimenopause, marching through all of our reproductive life cycles. The perimenopause is a window of vulnerability, right? We all know this in the development of depressive symptoms because we remember that reproductive life cycle. Most midlife women who experience a major depressive episode during perimenopause have experienced a prior episode of depression. Okay, so screening for depression is important, and it's helpful to understand that this is a recurrence. It might be a recurrence of a pre-existing condition. There's inconsistent evidence of an increased risk in women without depression prior to midlife. The data are a little bit mixed to kind of spontaneously have depression as soon as you hit menopause. What are some other risk factors? Mental health factors that we talked about, like prior depression, current use of antidepressants, anxiety. There are sociodemographic factors, psychosocial factors, and menopausal symptoms. So hot flashes, sleep dysfunction can set you up. There's a very important overlap, again, between depression and the symptoms of menopause. And that might cause us all to scratch our heads and wonder, is this really depression, or are we talking about menopause, or are we talking about both? So I like this Venn diagram because it helps you see where the overlap in symptoms might be. Okay? Cognitive shifts, sleep disturbances, sexual disturbances, energy changes, and weight changes all happen in both. So really useful, again, to understand how these overlap and how they differentiate or distinguish. What do you do with menopause? First-line treatments for a major depressive episode during menopause are antidepressants, cognitive behavioral therapy, and other psychotherapies. Data on SSRIs and SNRIs show good efficacy and safety at usual doses. We got some tools that we know work. SSRIs and SNRIs are also really helpful for improving menopausal-related complaints like vasomotor symptoms and pain. And you've got an FDA indication for vasomotor symptoms associated with menopause with Paxil or paroxetine. And desvenlafaxine also has strong data supporting use for this particular indication. Okay? In women with a history of depression, a prior adequate response to a particular antidepressant should guide treatment selection. Something worked before? Let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's try something new. If something in the past hasn't worked. Other things to think about. Estrogen therapy is effective for managing depression with symptoms in perimenopausal women, with or without the vasomotor symptoms. And it's not effective for managing depressive disorders in postmenopausal therapy. So helpful to understand, good for symptoms, not for the disorder. Hormonal or contraceptives, like when used continuously, may improve symptoms in women approaching menopause. And it's not unreasonable to recommend exercise, of course, again, particularly in combination with psychotherapy and pharmacotherapy. How do you treat those sleep problems that are so problematic in menopause? Declining estrogen levels are really the culprit there, with difficulty falling and staying asleep. Hormone therapy can reduce sleep fragmentation and with reduced wakefulness and arousals. And cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, is also effective and recommended. And then there's the psychotropic agents that you can try, Lunesta, escitalopram, and gabapentin, all that have shown some efficacy in treating insomnia in perimenopausal and postmenopausal women. So, in summary, for some women, increased risk for mood disorders is associated with reproductive cycle events. Abnormal reaction to normal reproductive steroid hormone changes and to normal stress hormone mechanisms, including allopregnanolone signaling, as is true for brexanolone. This is why it's so important to understand that because these shifts happen normally or typically, how do we help recalibrate the balance or the homeostasis for these women? First-line treatments for PMDD include SSRIs and SNRIs and certain oral contraceptives. First-line treatments for perinatal depression depends on severity, but includes the psychosocial interventions that we talked about, SSRIs and brexanolone. And for perimenopausal depression, it depends on the stage of menopause. But You might consider SSRIs, SNRIs, hormone therapy, and psychotherapies.